So as you can read, the topic of this talk is going to be like dwarf galaxies in the local group and how they have been tidally affected by, as a population. So I think the main interest, or at least personally for me, is to study dwarf galaxies in the local group is to understand how these systems have formed, for example, in a cosmological paradigm. I think there are really many interesting things about these objects that can provide a lot of constraints on the way the stars form in dark matter halos. And the reason is that dwarf galaxies are very old, as you know, and they must be embedded in the least massive dark matter halos that were able to retain some gas fraction from stars. So that's more or less the motivation. But if you study this presence, these objects today, since they are so close to the host galaxies, to the Milky Way and M31 in particular, it's very likely the properties have been affected by tidal interactions and mass stripping. So before we can say something about the formation of these systems, we have to understand how much these properties may have varied as a result of mass loss. So this more or less was, in a nutshell, what I wanted to do when I arrived to Victoria and I posed this project to Julio. And we came out with this working plan. So the first point, of course, is to have an idea of the models that we have to use to simulate the evolution of dwarf galaxies in a tidal field. So the first point will be to constrain from observational data how dwarf galaxies, the properties of dwarf galaxies, assuming something about the dark matter halo. Once we have done that, what we do is embody simulations of these models, analytical models, and study how the system evolves in a tidal field. As you will see, it's not even if you understand from a theoretical point of view how this tidal evolution occurs, it's not clear at all whether we can say something about, we can see dwarf galaxies say, okay, this system may have lost this and that fraction of the stars or of dark matter. So the third point is really to study in detail whether we can find some signature that can tell us how a system has been perturbed by tidal interaction. So this is going to be the basic properties of our models. In principle, we can use more realistic or at least relaxed the model assumptions, but what we wanted to have is more or less an idea of how the properties of this system with a model that is as simple as possible and is based on cosmological predictions. So for that reason we use NFW profiles for our dark matter halos, for the dark matter halos surrounding dwarf galaxies. There can be, as you know, it's not clear at all whether this assumption is correct or not, because there have been some studies that say, okay, the cusp of dark matter halos is -1, it might be -1.5, -0.8, etc. So there is some degree of freedom in this assumption. Also, NFW halos are only accurate for systems that are in isolation, and this is exactly what we doubt about the present population of dwarf galaxies. So that will be a problem, but we have addressed these problems, and I will come back to this in a few moments. So once we have some assumption for the dark matter profile, we can embed a stellar component within this, with HALO, to simulate the properties of the stars. And from observations, we see actually that a good representation from the stellar component is a Keane profile. Although, as Nicola was showing in a recent paper, this might not be true for systems that have very low luminosity. But in principle, we can address that too in the future. So the third assumption is that stars are tracers of the potential. They don't contribute to the potential of the dwarf galaxy. And the reason is that the mass-to-layer ratio of dwarf galaxies is very high. So I think that assumption that the stars are simply tracers of the underlying potential is okay. Okay, with those assumptions, with these models, analytic, we can simply assume that these systems are in equilibrium, which is also a fair assumption. In the crossing times, you will see the crossing time of the system is very small, it's between 10 and 100 mega years. We can assume that they are in dynamical equilibrium and solve the Jeans equations. But
how do you set up the initial velocity field?
The initial velocity field? No, this is just an analytical model.
It's just analytical.
This is analytical so far. So this is more or less like, how should I, produce, what kind of n-body models should I produce? What properties? And for that, you will see, we constrain those properties from observation. So
what's the evidence that that the profiles are King models?
Well, the King model seems to be quite accurate, and if you don't go very deep, at least if it's only 2 decades in the surface runner profile, King model seems to be very accurate. Once you go deeper than that, some systems show an excess of stars with respect to the King profile. Other systems show that, like Fornax, they are perfect King models. So, yeah, that's right. But I'll come back to that.
It must be a function of glycosidic radius, too.
Right? I will come back. It's the third part of the talk. But in principle, the main parameter, actually, is like, if you think about it, we have a given NFW halo. So what's the embeddedness? How should I distribute the stars? In other words, you can use very concentrated stellar components that are located in the center, or you can use more and more extended stars. So this is a free parameter, and you will see it's extremely important for the evolution of dwarf galaxies. But this is a free parameter that we can, in principle, hope to constrain from observation. So if you have these models for these various values of the segregation parameter, which we define simply as the stellar core radius divided by Rmax, where Rmax is the radius where velocity of the halo peaks.
Is it essential to the models that the stars are concentric to the dark matter?
These are spherical models. So
okay.
So that's another assumption, of course. And so if you solve the Jeans equation with all these assumptions, what you find is already 2 interesting points. It's like extended stellar models within the same NFW profile seem to are monotonically declining with radius. So these dots are the stellar core radius. So you see, you go from the center to the outskirts, and you at the core radius, the velocity dispersion has dropped by a factor 2. If you embed more and more the stellar component, what happens is two things. First of all, you lower the velocity dispersion, the projective velocity dispersion at all radii. And secondly, and more interestingly, the velocity dispersion profile becomes flat, flatter and flatter. You see here the core radius. When this is a factor, the segregation parameter is a factor 20 smaller than this. And here the velocity dispersion profile is basically flat, almost out to the entire radius. And this is interesting because Matthew Walker was showing that actually for the brightest dwarf galaxies, the velocity dispersion profiles of the system seem to be flat, without exception.
One of the axes are log, and the other one is linear. So
yeah.
What scale is a tenth of the scale radius?
The scale radius is represented by these dots.
So they're flat within a tenth of the scale radius on the right plot. But you're showing us...
This one or this one?
It doesn't matter. Any of these are basically flat within a tenth of the scale radius, right?
This one goes, for example, the core radius of this system must be around this position, I guess, where most of the stars are.
Right. These are flatter to larger radius than...
And these are flatter to larger. So these, for example, you almost go the core radius. So this would be a factor, 2 or 3, and it's still flat. So this is 3 core radii, more or less. Or even 4, and it's still flat. So basically, this is the tidal radius, almost.
Okay.
And this is log, so you can read it directly. In any case, this is a hint that might be.
You assume what velocity in isotropy?
That was another assumption, that we assume isotropic orbits for the stars, and that will change the values we estimate afterwards. For the masses of these systems, but as you can see in the last plot, what happens is that if you fix the velocity dispersion and you want to, for example, to decrease the velocity dispersion from your model, there are 2 ways: either you decrease the mass of your halo, or you embed more your stars. So there is a degeneracy here, and we need another constraint. This is what this curve is showing, is that the degeneracy of NFW parameters, all of these, all the points along this curve can produce the same central velocity dispersion. So we need another constraint. We have this constraint from cosmological models, which show that actually NFW halos show a relationship between the mass and the concentration, or in other words, between Rmax and Vmax. So we can use these results from embodied cosmological simulations, which is one of them, to constrain the second parameter of the NFW halos. So we do that for all the for the brightest dwarfs in the Milky Way, and show for each of them that this is the degeneracy curve and this is the cosmological relationships, which depend on redshift. But the dependence here, you can see, is very small. It's between set equals 0 and set equals 2. It's very small dependence in comparison with all the huge degeneracy that we have. So we just use set equals 0, which, again, introduces another.
Yeah? Is Vmax actually known for all these dwarfs?
It's not known. It's what we want to measure or to estimate.
So how is it a constraint?
So what we have is for a given stellar distribution, we have a range of Vmax, Rmax that reproduce the central velocity dispersion for this. So what we do is to use the value where these two degeneracy curves cross. This is basically, these dots here are the values of Rmax and Vmax that reproduce the central velocity dispersion that you observe and are in agreement with the cosmological expectation. It's the same thing for all the systems. So if you do that for the brightest of galaxies, what we reproduce is what, you know, Marla was telling us the other day, what we've been discussing, is that the mass within the core radius of these systems, this is the mass within the core radius, no M300, seems to be more or less 10 to the 7 solar masses. This is the old result of Matteo, 98. And it's actually it's equivalent to the dynamical mass of this system for a very large range of luminosities. So this is an interesting result. But more interestingly, as you are going to see, is the values that we get for RC divided by Rmax, the segregation parameter. What we find actually is that this segregation parameter that you can read here for all these dwarf galaxies in the Milky Way is between 0.1 and 0.025. This is a factor 4, more or less, in the segregation. But the amazing thing is that when you calculate this NFW profile, the circular, the velocity profile of the circular velocity curve of these models, when you compute how much mass there is beyond these radii, what you find is that it's between 90 and 99% of the halo mass is beyond the volume where stars are located. So stars are extremely embedded, deeply embedded in the NFW halos or in the dark matter halos of these systems, if you believe for our assumptions. This has very strong consequences. So we go to the second part where we model, we take all these constraints that we've obtained and model and produce embodied simulations. And so this is our models. You can see the dark matter halo is red and the stars are this green. You can see the scale, how embedded they are, and put them in a tidal field that it simulates the Milky Way. And for that, for doing these simulations, I had to use at least 5 million particles. So in order to resolve the inner regions of the halos with sufficiently accuracy, the number of particles that you have to use is huge. And the thing is that if you use... Oh, sorry. Why is it not working? If you use less particles at this, your cast is not sufficiently resolved, and your stellar component doesn't stay in equilibrium. This will have very strong consequences for simulating how many streams you expect from cosmological simulations, or how much dwarf galaxies have been perturbed, etc. Because the Aquarius simulation has a mass resolution of 10 to the 3. It's the best resolution, best simulation we have. That means that for a system with 10 to the 7, 10 to the 8, you will have like 10,000, 100,000 particles, which is still, if my models are right, a factor between 50 and 500 less than what you need to do these studies properly. And you can see, what if you look at the movie that I produced here, it happens what more or less we expected. You have to strip all the dark matter halo before you, and beyond the luminous radius before you can strip stars. You can see here, it's only after 8 gigayears in this, with these parameters, that you have been able to strip some stellar component, and some stream, you know, shows here. Sorry that there is too much light probably to see it. But this process goes on and on, and you stream more and more stars. But this process of stellar mass stripping has been delayed by a lot. This means that if you don't get the embeddedness of the stellar component right, your results are going to be extremely different if you use, you know, hierarchical formation of galaxies. So all the simulations that have aimed to simulate, all the simulations that have studied the formation of stellar halos or the thick disks, etc., I think that they didn't have enough resolution.
How did you set up the initial conditions?
So the initial conditions are just an NFW with a stellar component that has the profile that I was showing you before in equilibrium.
How did you model equilibrium?
Oh, it's just the Eddington equation. So you solve.
You use the Eddington equation.
Yeah.
So you don't use the distribution function. You use a Gaussian.
I compute the.
So I mean, there's been some controversy about whether or not that's.
The distribution function is not, but the distribution function that you get is the correct one. It's not Maxwellian. So if you are.
There's not even a controversy. It's a bad approximation.
Right. Yeah. So you're saying that the velocity distribution is not Maxwellian.
No. What I say is that the code that I used to form the NFW halo, I got it from Kazantzidis, who used the correct or the self-consistent distribution function. So and then I use what I do is okay. What's the fraction of stars at the given radio that are going to reproduce the King profile that I want to embed here?
So
this system is in perfect equilibrium for.
Right. But the stellar velocity distribution is not the King profile velocity distribution.
The stellar velocity distribution is just what you would expect if you solve the Chin's equations. This is that I was showing before.
Assuming isotropy.
But the initial condition. So there's two profiles in the initial conditions.
Well, what there is in reality, there is only one profile because the stars are only tracers. So what I do is at a given radius select
the dark matter. That velocity distribution will be different than the dark matter, right?
Yes.
So you're approximating. I think that the density of stars, the density profile of stars, and the velocity distribution of the stars aren't consistent. Is that?
Yeah, they are consistent.
I mean, you assume that they don't contribute to potential, and so potential is set, and then the King profile gives you the density distribution, and that fixes the loss dispersion if you assume isotropy.
It's exactly the same thing that you do for the Jeans equations. If you don't get the same, you are doing something wrong.
I just know that if you take, say, two Hernquist profiles and you bed one inside the other, the velocity, the distribution function changes, right?
And the mass fraction is significant in the second.
Exactly.
But if it's insignificant, then...
Well, it doesn't depend on the mass fraction as much. It depends on where the potential dominates. If it dominates anywhere, then it's going to change.
Right. In this case, the stars don't contribute at all to the potential. So you only have one potential. So one component, so to say. What you can imagine is that I'm painting particles so that I get the right weights to simulate the King profile of the stars.
I mean, because you're starting to go into sort of like getting inferences from the results that that there are differences in how you get tails.
So you have to paint them in the right way so that they have the right.
I mean, again, when you did your analysis, you did two big assumptions. One is that the structure of the halos in which the stars are embedded now are described by equilibrium in the W profile that you expect by isolated halos in cosmological simulations, whereas we know that if halos were already heavily stripped, the concentrations would be much, much higher. So R max V max relation would be different from what you assumed. The second big assumption is velocity and isotropy. So I wonder, I mean, if you tweak, could tweak those two assumptions. So how much smaller can you go in terms of?
We haven't explored the velocity anisotropy, but there are many papers doing that. For example, Strigari have been doing that and see how the effects are, what the effects are. And what you get basically, the results are more or less. The only thing that you get is a bigger uncertainty in the Vmax or mass parameters.
That means that that these galaxies can actually be embedded in much smaller halos than what you're seeing here, right?
Yeah, you have an error bar there, that an uncertainty in this biome. And the second thing, which is also very interesting, is like it's true that when you strip an NFW halo, it's not an NFW halo in the outer regions anymore. You keep the inner cusp unaltered. So what we did was actually to do in this paper, and I can show you later, what we did was to examine how our estimates of the first paper were affected by the fact that this system might have been, you know, in a tidal field. This is what I was showing you the other day. So what we found actually is that our estimates of Bmax are pretty accurate, but the estimates of Rmax, and I will come back to this later because I think it's important.
But as the model continues, do you maintain the King profile? Like,
and the King profile evolves.
It does evolve.
It does evolve.
In what way?
Well,
let's say if it was an isolated.
I will come back to this, and this is what we have. I will show how it evolves. But it evolves. So what you can see here is for different set of orbits, what we do is to fit a King profile to the stellar distribution at all time steps. And I'm just showing the points at the apocenters of the orbit because at that time the system has had time to relax after the pericenter interactions. So if you fit a King profile, which is again a good representation in the inner regions of the stellar components, this would be the evolution of the central surface brightness, of the central velocity dispersion, of the core radius, and the concentration of the King model. So you see that the evolution is similar independently of the orbits and of the concentration of stellar components, etc. It's always the same. For example, a prediction is that the central surface brightness drops if the system loses stars.
But what about the fidelity of the profile? Measure four parameters, but does it make a good fit?
It's a good fit. It's a good fit for these parameters. I didn't include this plot because I thought that particular plot, and I can show you maybe but later. But it's a good fit. I will show you. I will come back to how the system the stellar profile evolves. But in general, what you find is that the surface brightness drops, the velocity dispersion drops, the core radius becomes smaller as a function of time, and the concentration of the King component increases as a function of time. But as you see, there is a big dependence on the orbital parameters, on the initial concentration of your King component. This is what I'm showing here for different dots and colors. But if you plot all the same dots as a function of how much the system loses within the core radius, what you see is very interesting thing is that all these dots distribute on single lines. This is what we call the tidal evolutionary tracks of the King models embedded in an NFW profile. And it only depends on this parameter, how much mass a system has lost within the stellar radius. This will depend on the dark matter profile. Especially, this will be sensitive to the inner cusp because this is where stars live. For NFW, this line is unique, as you can see here. This doesn't mean that we don't need to know the orbit of a system or of a given dwarf spheroidal in order to, you know, to know how much it has evolved. Because if you want to estimate how much this parameter has changed, then you have to know all this information, you know, the orbit and the initial mass, etc.
Is your line of analytical prediction, or is it a fit to the?
It's a fit to the point. So this is what you get. It's quite a good fit. And you can see here how far we go. It's like, in fact, more than 90% of the mass within that particular radius has been lost. The mass and the amount of stars that you lose are also correlated. So this is going to be a more interesting parameter to compare with observations, because, for example, in principle, you could go to Sagittarius and say, okay, how many stars are in the stream? And you will get this variation of the luminosity directly from observations. Another thing I wanted to show is the evolution of the mass to light ratio. You know how much mass you lose, you know how much luminosity you've lost. You can plot here the evolution of the mass to light ratio. And this is an interesting result. It's like, for when the system starts to lose stars, like here, you can read it from factor 2, mass to light ratio doesn't change much. But once the system has lost more than say 90% of the stars, the mass to light ratio should increase dramatically.
Why, when the initial losses, there's not a stronger change in the mass to light ratio?
Yeah. The reason is, like, if you remember how the movie looked like, you start stripping dark matter first. So the stars are very well embedded in the halos, and you don't lose stars. So at the beginning, you lose predominantly dark matter.
So then I would expect the mass to light ratio to change drastically until the end of the process.
No, because you lose predominantly mass in the outer regions of the dark matter halos.
Where is it measured, the mass to light ratio?
The mass to light ratio is measured at the core radius.
Yeah, so you can measure it.
Yeah, because this is something that we can measure, right? We don't know very far out. But since the stars are, you know, a core profile embedded in a Caspi profile, once you start to lose stars, you lose stars predominantly, and this means that mass to light ratio increases. This is because CASPs are really resilient to tidal interactions. So this result, although it looks very innocent, it says that basically you cannot convert a spheroidal into something that, you know, like I was thinking here of Omega Centauri. People say that it could be the remnants of a dwarf galaxy, but this result would disagree with that statement, because as you lose stars, your system becomes more and more dark matter dominated, and this is not the case for Omega Centauri, for example.
Is it because the stars have core distribution?
That's right.
Where is Caspi?
That's right.
What is the mass ratio for Omega Centauri?
I think it's a stellar mass. It's compatible with no
hand. With a regular mass function, so it's like.
Yeah, but there's no evidence for dark matter in
right.
Omega 10.
But would that hold if Omega 10 was some, you know, very dense nucleus in the center of the source?
That's right. That could be, because this system assumed that the very high mass to light ratio from the very beginning. So if you have a system where baryons dominate the potential, then this will change.
Okay. But we certainly see dwarf spheroidals or dwarf ellipticals that are, you know, just on the nucleus sitting right in the center. So,
yeah, for example, you cannot apply this model for those ellipticals because they are. You know,
what's the orbit of Mesa?
It's very close to the. I think it goes. It's a placenta, I think it's like something like 15 kiloparsecs.
Right, the key thing is the
pericenter, I don't remember, but very short, very small. And it's gone through a lot of interactions. I modeled once the orbit, but I don't remember very well.
It doesn't look like, yeah. I don't think it's that close. I think it's remarkably circular, but not really. You know.
It's basically circular.
I don't think so. No. That's a way. That's an exaggeration. But it's not like it gets within 1 kiloparsec and goes out to 15 kiloparsec.
And is it really positive to be a dwarf spheroidal, or is it?
Not dwarf spheroidal. Dwarf elliptical, nucleated dwarf elliptical, something like that.
So not something you
model. No. Would be interesting though to have, you know, different potential, which is determines the evolution of the system. And this basically we wanted to. These tracks were very interesting because for the first time you can go and say, okay, we know how a dwarf galaxy, the observational properties of dwarf galaxies are going to evolve as a result of tidal mass stripping. So we can go now to the space, so to the planes of observables. Here I'm plotting the surface brightness versus luminosity, core radius or the half-life radius versus luminosity, mass to light ratio, and this is the central velocity dispersion. So this is a very interesting plot. Well, let me explain what the dots are. The blue dots are the Milky Way dwarf galaxies, and the red are the M31 dwarf galaxies. These green things here are the globular clusters, are globular clusters in the Milky Way. And something, these are dwarf ellipticals. And for some reason, they seem to follow all these relationships very strangely.
Why is it strange?
Well, because there are very different systems, right? You have dwarf spheroidals. Yep. But they must have formed in a very different way. So, you know, why should they distribute in the same relationships that the dwarf spheroidals when are totally Dharmata-dominated, blah, blah, blah. So you would expect them to...
Yeah, I don't see any evidence for why they didn't... They're just, you know, have different mass-light ratios and they lie on the same relationships. It's not obvious to me why there's a different formation mechanism between the dwarf spheroidals and the dwarf ellipticals.
Do ellipticals fall on these things just at higher?
Yeah,
is these to extend real ellipticals, not for, like, serious ones? Do they fall on all these relations too, or?
So it's a controversial answer, and I now believe that the answer is yes. And so you used to say that the ellipticals and dwarf ellipticals fall on different parts of, like, the fundamental plane.
I mean, this is what Roland was talking about.
Right. But now, as you start to fill in sort of this intermediate mass region, it does seem like they lie on sort of the same relationships and however you plot.
In any case, something that surprised us is that the evolutionary tracks we were deriving before seem to run parallel to these relationships in all the planes, except here. But I will come to this later.
What are the open squares and circles, did you say?
Open squares are the recently discovered dwarf spheroidals in both galaxies. So we wanted to distinguish between them, although there is no clear transition in these relationships.
So, and dots along the curve just show as a function of the mass loss?
Yeah, the luminosity loss. So in principle, if you knew where a system was born on these planes, you could place on top of every of these dots one of these lines and say, if this system loses stars, it's going to evolve that way for every single of them. But since we don't know how much they have already lost stars, we don't know on which part of this curve they are. So for example, this dot would be they have lost already 90% of stars. Maybe we can place this dot here in Sagittarius, which is this triangle, and that would be that Sagittarius originally was up here, more or less.
Is there any correlation between, like, do the newly discovered dwarfs, the open squares, are they on particularly dangerous orbits that would mean that they would have lost more mass, or?
Not clear correlation, no, Marla?
There's a selection function. So, oh, yeah. You know, the ones that the ones that we see are very close into the Milky Way, simply because you can't find the ones that are farther out.
But their orbits still didn't know, or something you said about.
Well, for example, for Segway 1, you know more or less what's the galactocentric radial velocity, at least the projection. So more or less you can estimate how far the apocentric is going to be. But since we don't know the transversal motion, you will have always a very large uncertainty. Unless you find a very particular configuration, you know, orientation, like LEO 1, which is so far that actually you can assume that all the velocity is in the radial direction.
So we really have no information because they're all very close. We have no information.
Some of them
are. I thought you just said that selection effect is not too close.
For the new ones.
Right. So we don't have any information, even though they're close on the proper motion.
No. Close is like, what, 50? I mean, so the close isn't close like 5, which is what you need to do good. Mm-hmm. Right. A 50 KPC is then you have 22 on proper motions with it.
And not in 1 year, because most of these guys were discovered in 2000. You know,
there is an approved HST project now to go after as many as possible. So hopefully the refurbishing mission. That's what's his name?
And
it's to get proper motions, it's not just to get deeper color magnetic.
Right, it's to get proper motions, it's using the same thing, the same technique that they use to get proper motions of the other dwarf spheroidals. It's tough because there's less stars in the field.
So this result, in principle, although it looks interesting, but it's a little bit unfortunate because imagine if the evolution would have been that way, then we would know whether, you know, outliers, we would expect outliers here from the typical distribution. But unfortunately, if a system it's evolve, it's going to evolve down these relationships. So it's going to be hard to know whether how much the system has been driven.
Why is that unfortunate and maybe not just the result of that all the systems started out there? I mean, maybe this is just a track of evolution.
Yeah. Well, because if, you know, theoretically you would have predicted such a curve, then you would expect some systems here, the ones that have been stripped. But it seems
maybe theoretically you predicted that, then they would all be strung out like that.
If the theory is good, it is correct, yes.
I think it's just that there are models that predict this relation without tidal evolution.
Yeah, for example, these.
It could be intrinsic before these galaxies fell into the halo. This relation was already there.
Well, this is more or less what we say in this paper. We conclude.
What's the basis of those predictions?
Sort of like a fundamental plane type models.
So just the way that, you know, the underlying galaxy formation model says this is what you're going to come out with for a region.
Another hint that might be the case that this system have not, you know, may have not been strongly perturbed by stellar mass stripping is that when you plot the evolution of the central velocity dispersion, if you want to form these systems by stripping the bright galaxies, the bright dwarf spheroidals, then you would predict a drop of the velocity dispersion that is much larger than what we measure. So in other words, if you strip these systems, the bright ones, you will end up with velocity dispersion that are 1 or 2 kilometers per second, and we measure, well, not we, but people that measure velocity dispersion profile, measure something like 4, 5, 6 kilometers per second.
What about elasticity? So we discussed this last week, but I mean, if you make an elasticity luminosity diagram, do you get the same type of track, and then do you get that same type of...
You mean how the
elasticity of the stellar component in the center?
I don't think it's going to change that much, because basically what determines the evolution of these stellar observables or parameters is how much the potential has changed, mm-hmm. how much mass you lose within a given radius.
So those results would be different if you started with a non-spherical halo?
Not much. One has to do it, right? But I don't think it's going to be a major parameter. It's going to be much more important if you have, for example, a core dark matter halo. That's going to be a very different evolutionary track, I think. It would be interesting to look. Because, for example, that might be the case. If you put core halos here, you will have something like that, for example. And then, you know, it wouldn't be so clear if you don't find any dwarf spheroidal here. The conclusion would be either the core, you know, core dark matter halos don't exist, or all the systems have not been stripped. In any case, what these results were another interesting result before I go on. When we plot Vmax, you can plot Vmax now from our estimates as a function of luminosity, and what we find is this kind of correlation, very mild correlation with luminosity is more or less like this. And it seems that the recently discovered systems are a little bit less massive than the bright dwarf spheroidals. And when you plot how much the Vmax would evolve in your system, or the estimate of Vmax would evolve when you strip it, this would be the evolutionary track. And what you can see is that if you strip the system a lot, you would end up down here. In other words, this major or very radical decrease of Vmax, of the estimated Vmax, is again a result of the stars are more resilient to tides than dark matter. You lose before you strip stars, you lose a lot of dark matter. So Vmax has a very sharp decrease. And we don't see systems, or we haven't detected systems with very, very low Vmax. So in other words, it seems that all these systems have to live in halos that have very similar masses, unless all have decreased a lot and were formed with this Vmax, unless all of them were very, very massive to start with. But I would say that the fact that we find Vmax, or we estimate values for Vmax that only have a variation of factor 3, you know, in 10,000 for a variation in luminosity of 10,000 is telling us that maybe these systems have not been dramatically perturbed by tides, or they have not lost a lot of stars, better say it. Sorry.
If you take an isolated system like CETUS and you put it through the Euroevolutionary track, then you end up with something like, I don't know, Hercules.
Yeah, this is what I was saying, like, unless all these are, you know, remnants of systems like CETUS or something like that. But in principle, most of them have only variation in Vmax factor 3.
No, but how come CETUS wouldn't go to Borodas? I don't know, just by eye, it looks like if I put the little slide on CETUS and slid down it, I might end up in that area.
Yeah, you would end up like this is... 1 point something. Yeah, you end up here.
If you took CETUS and you stripped it, or, you know, to just talking about metallicities, because we see that there is a pretty strong correlation between luminosity and the metallicities in these systems. And so if you took CETUS and stripped it, you wouldn't be getting the right metallicities out.
What's the metallicity of CETUS?
No.
but it's
much more metal rich.
It's not quite fair because things that were heavily stripped, they were not, you know, they weren't evolved like CETUS to redshift zero. I mean, there were things that were stopped changing their metallicity at redshift three or so. Mm-hmm. You know, so you should compare it to systems with metallicity systems at that redshift, not at the CETUS today. So I don't think it's that strong of a constraint.
No, probably not redshift three, because don't forget the strong intermediate age population in a lot of these systems. You know, some of them didn't stop forming stars until a few giga years ago.
That's fine, but we don't know when they would stop forming stars as Halo gets stripped. I mean, they can continue maybe forming stars as they orbit.
Well, Sag dwarf case in point.
But I guess it's a little bit worrisome to have them fall so nicely on the mass metallicity relationship for galaxies, which I think that they do, right? For, you know, you go all the way up to the most massive galaxies and have all of a sudden the reason why they fall in that mass metallicity relationship when they were stripped, when the mass metallicity relationship for bigger galaxies has nothing to do with when they were falling into big halos and being stripped. I mean, nothing to do with
that. No, but if they had gas and they're continuing to evolve due to the tidal forcing and shocks that come from the forcing, then that's going to actually drive multiple generations of stars.
Why are the stars in the middle in the first place?
Why are the stars in the middle of what? Say it again.
In the first place.
Where are the stars in the first place?
Some initial conditions.
Why are they in the middle?
This is what we want to know, no?
Okay, but you're the speakers here to tell us.
That's probably where all the dense gas goes. You're not going to get dense gas randomly throughout the system. Well, but the cooling will go up, the pressure goes up, so that you will more readily form molecules.
So, is that a function of the, you know, because we have these different mass systems, is that expected to be a strong function of the mass of the system?
Yeah.
That segregation?
Well, yeah. I mean, there are other factors.
It may also be stochastic in the sense that the mass function of dark matter halos is very different than the luminosity function. So we don't know how to populate the halos with galaxies yet, right? There's more than one way of doing it.
But do you think, Brent, that you can cool the system so much that you can get these segregations, you know, like of stars that live within 1% of the total halo mass, virial mass? Because that has to be a major cooling.
We don't know what the initial distribution of angular momentum in the gas is. So if there was a low angular momentum tail, you know, why not? But we don't really know. We know what it is for the dark matter. And in the dark matter, there is a low angular momentum tail. But we don't really know what it is for the gas to start off with.
All right. But that's basically what all these questions are reflecting, only one thing. It's like, we don't know whether what the systems that we are seeing today have been severely stripped or not. You know, they could be that they were before here or not. And if we don't answer that question, it's very difficult to have a clear mechanism of how stars formed in these systems to begin with. So that's what motivated Before I go that, I should discuss here what I've been doing with Andre and Rossi last week. So another parameter that actually is being discussed now is the Q parameter, which has the dimension of this phase-based density. And apparently, all dark matter halos seem to have the same Q profile. It's a power law, and well, you change the normalization, but the profile of the Q parameter seems to be the same. This is Q. So when you, this is something that these guys did, Valka et al. In 2006. They compared the Q parameter of dwarf galaxies measured this way with the bulges and those of the globular clusters. And for some reason, they found that actually the bulges and the dwarf galaxies seem to follow the same correlation. Although one has to be aware that since this is the dynamical mass within the light radius, all dwarf galaxies have more or less 10 to the 7. So we basically, for the dwarf galaxy population, we have only one point here. And if we don't include Segway 1, which seems to have a little bit lower mass within the light radius, according to Marla's estimates. But in any case, what I did was, okay, this is not very good because, we only have one point. Let's take a look to the value of the Q parameter as a function of luminosity. So I went back to the previous plot, took all these parameters, and this is what I found for the system for which I could calculate this Q. So these blue dots are the Milky Way dwarf spheroidals. This is Sagittarius, and these are the M31 dwarf spheroidals. So interestingly, when you calculate the evolution of the Q parameter for a system that is losing stars from the evolutionary tracks that I was showing before, you can do that very easily. You find that this is, again, a similar thing. Like the evolution of this system seems to be more or less parallel to the relationship that we observe. Interestingly, you find that M31 dwarfs, for which I had data, have lower values by a factor more or less of 10 of Q. And this, I think, only reflects the fact that the N31 dwarf spheroidals, on average, seem to be twice as extended than the Milky Way dwarf spheroidals for some reason. I don't really know why that can be.
It doesn't seem strictly kosher, does it?
It doesn't seem strictly what?
Kosher.
Yeah. Yeah. It would be interesting, for example, to go to lower slight luminosities.
This is the Q of the stars?
This is the Q of the stars measured in that way. So you just calculate dynamical mass, you know the half-life radius, and then this is the central projective velocity dispersion, which is...
Well, it just seems like a very... some observational problem or something, because it's hard to believe it's real.
I might disagree with that. It's not very strong, actually. But let's show you. So if you go to this, cosmologists have measured this value, this Q parameter for halos. This is the average. This is the average mass of. This is the real mass of a halo, and they find that the average Q value actually goes that way, follows this kind of track. So when we actually, in the previous plot I was showing, we derive, you can fit here a line, and you find this kind of correlation that Vmax is proportional to L2 0.15. When you take the cosmological prediction that the real mass is proportional to Vmax to this value, we end up with a mass of a real mass that is proportional to L to the 0.5. So if you now take this and put this correlation, then what we find is Q proportional to L to minus 4, 0.4. And this is this dotted line that I was showing here. So, more or less, the correlation that you find, that you predict from cosmology, is more or less what you observe for the dwarf spheroidals. This is...
that result is Milky Way 31.
Well, they seem to have, you can fit kind of a line here, but I agree, you need more observations. But why would you say that it's not possible?
So,
I just don't see why a dwarf spheroidal would be affected by the M31 environment in such a violent way.
Well, this is an observational fact. Like, people measure...
Well, it's not an observation. I wouldn't call it an observational fact. I mean, something that observers tell us, probably incorrectly.
But it seems to be. I mean, these guys know what they do, and they have measured the surface brightness profiles, theta king, in the same way that you do for the Milky Way dwarfs, and they find it's quite a strong correlation. But
how well are the distances known to these galaxies?
Well, yes, that's the answer to the thing.
That's pretty well.
Yeah, 30, 40 kiloparsecs.
Yeah, they know that.
Can I ask you about this transformation from Q proportional to the minus 0.8? And yeah,
this one? Okay.
I mean, that only holds if sigma is the same for the stars in the dark matter zone.
Why? I mean, this is the prediction from cosmology.
From cosmology, that's right. So that's and this sigma is what the dark matter.
This is the mass of the dark matter.
Mass of the dark matter. So
and this
sigma,
is and this is the mass of the dark matter as well.
But so, you know, the cosmology is not predicting anything about Q, which is about the stars.
Well, this Q is for the dark matter halos, and this is the dark matter mass.
Right. So it's mass of the dark matter halo, R of the dark matter halo, sigma of the dark matter halo.
Well, in this for dark matter halos, they use this, the density of them and the velocity of
So there's some relationship between M and R and M and sigma. And then you get a relationship between Q and
right,
M.
Right,
right. But that's for the dark matter sigma.
Right, but this is...
Stellar sigma is different.
Right, but I don't use a stellar sigma. What I use is this Vmax that I measure here, right? Then, you know, this is the relationship I find from the dwarf, for the Milky Way dwarf spheroidal. I fit, yeah, this is just a crude estimate, but this is more or less. This is the curve that I'm fitting. This is what you see here. And then you have that the virial mass, the virial mass is proportional to Vmax to 3.5 for the dark matter. And this is what you have in the end. So this is dark matter and this is luminosity from the constraints that I have from the dwarf.
So the Q in the next plot is
exactly
the Q of the dark matter.
Right.
Okay.
Right, right. So both are consistent in the sense. So that's the interesting thing, like comparison, like you can compare here. In principle, both Qs are for dark matter. It's interesting. I don't know whether it's right, but
this is fresh off the press, done last week, correct?
Yeah, this is just my homework, so to say. Last week we had some interesting. I was discussing this with Andre, you know, and Rossi, and we say, okay, let's try to see whether we can estimate the Q parameter for this dwarf Milky Way dwarf spheroid. Here is the question. Like, you have asked me how the stellar distribution is going to change as a result of this stellar mass stripping. So we have analyzed that in detail. I didn't want to show it before because I'm going to show it now in detail. And this is more or less a paper that we have in preparation. So what we did was to take one of the models that was shown you before and throw these models through the pericenter and, you know, calculate the velocity, the distribution of stars at all time steps. So this is more or less what happens when you throw a system through the pericenter. And below you can see I measure the units of the in time are given in crossing times of the stars. So let me show again. When the system passes through the pericenter, some stars might be stripped because they gain some kinetic energy and they become unbound. So when they become unbound, they just escape the system. They escape the system along these tidal tails. So what you find actually is that if you plot the surface brightness profile as a function of radius at given snapshots after the pericenter interaction, what you can see is that you start with a king profile, truncated light profile here, and then the system evolves in the following way. So, the inner regions that I was telling you before can be accurately fitted by a curve or a king profile if you want. You know, you can just extend this a little bit, and this is in agreement with what I was showing before, that the light concentration of our model seems to increase as you strip more and more stars. the inner regions is still can be accurately fit by a King profile, but not the outermost regions. In the outermost regions, what you find actually is this excess of light that is moving outwards as time passes by. So what, interestingly, and you can see here the main result of the paper already, is that when you strip stars from a truncated light profile, the outcome is not a truncated light profile anymore. What you find, what we find, is that the remnants, the remnant core of this dwarf galaxy that has lost a fraction of the stars, is a power law. Once this unbound component disappears, because eventually it disappears. And actually, you can see that very nicely here. This is the mean radial velocity as a function of radius for the same course. Is that the outer regions, these stars, have very large radial velocities with respect to the dwarf. They are escaping from the dwarf. So when they escape, they leave behind something that is like a power law system. Actually, if you measure, this is the, well, another thing that I have to show here is the break radius. So the break radius is just, in these models, the break radius is simply the radius where the bound component, the surface radius of the bound component and the unbound component more or less are equal here. You can see that they correspond for the mean radial velocity is zero. This is the bound stars, and these are the escaping component. So this is the break radius. And when you measure the break radius as a function of time, what we find is a very nice correlation. It's like the break radius is simply proportional to the time passed since the pericentric interaction, multiplied here by the central velocity dispersion. And this makes sense, because what it's telling you simply is that as the unbound component will disappear after so few crossing times. Oh, so if you measure this in crossing times, you get that the correlation is the same for all of them. And this correlation that we find in other models is very useful now, because it's telling you that the radius where the unbound component dominates can be estimated if you know the orbit of the system and the velocity dispersion. So for a system like, say, I was discussing this with Marla, Segway-1, you want to know where you have to point your telescope to try to detect an unbound component escaping. What you do is to more or less estimate the orbit, if you can, and then multiply that by the velocity dispersion. That will tell you how far the unbound component has traveled since it became unbound. So this is useful, might be useful for observers, and it also provides a strong constraint if you want to know whether a light profile that has such a truncation radius, whether this truncation radius is induced by some unbound component, which would mean that the system is really heavily disruptive by tides, not disruptive, we were saying that disruptive is a bad word. Affected, so to say, or if you have lost a strong component. So you can see here the same profiles that I was showing before. What we did is more models and say, okay, maybe that happens only after the first pericentric interactions. But actually, it seems not to be the case. What we did was some models varying the how much stars you lose. For example, this red lost, this model has lost only 10% of the stars. Then we increase the mass loss, 20%, 60%, 90%. And it seems that independently of the number of orbits, the system that you end up, the remnants, always have this power law profile. No? And this, we find that the power law that you get is very similar or can be accurately reproduced by a Plummer profile. So what we say in this paper is that systems that are losing stars should distribute as a Plummer profile. So if you find a Plummer profile, that doesn't necessarily mean that the system is losing stars, because it can be formed that way. But if you find a truncated light profile, that would mean that this system has never lost any star due to tidal interactions. So that's interesting, because it would be easy. If you have deep enough data, you could examine the outer regions of these recently discovered dwarf spheroids and say, do they distribute as Plummer, or do they show this truncated stellar component? And that will tell you something about how much they have been perturbed by tides. So this is exactly what we did, for at least for the brightest dwarf galaxies. The first one is Sagittarius. And what you see is Sagittarius shows more or less what you can fit by a planar file. This is the stream. You are getting to the Sagittarius stream here. And as expected, it shows up like an excess of material at outer regions. Interestingly, there is also some bump in the inner regions that Majewski, this is Majewski 2003 data, didn't understand. They didn't know why you show this bump, you know, so close to Sagittarius center. So what we did for Sagittarius was, since we have the proper motions, as we know that it's being tidally disrupted now, it's losing stars, our model should be able to reproduce it. So according to the formula that was shown before, we should be able to know where the break radius should be, right? Because we know the orbit, we know the central velocity dispersion. So we calculate where is the break radius according to our model. And this is from the last pericentric interaction, we found that the break radius should be here. However, it's interesting. It would be interesting to measure the velocities and see whether the stars are, for example, have very radial orbits, if you can say. Somehow you can say that. But it doesn't explain this break radius at large radius. So what we did was say, okay, maybe this break radius is not from the last pericentric interaction, but from the previous one. Because the previous one, according to the orbital estimate, occurred 1 giga-year ago. So if the material that became unbound 1 giga-year ago should be still around Sagittarius. So this is more or less what we find. Our model will predict the position of break radius here, which is actually in quite good agreement within the error bars.
So this way you can use these kinks to find pericentric passages as indicators, right? So each one, if you really had some super exquisite profile, right, then each one of these kinks would actually reflect a different, if that break radius really was.
That's right. So this is more or less what we did. We went to all these systems and tried for which we have some orbital estimate and say, okay, do they show a break radius? Should they show a break radius? Could we see the break radius according to the orbit? And this is what we did for the rest. For Fornax, it's very interesting because Fornax is one of the few that shows a truncated light profile. And if you believe in these models, this means that Fornax has never lost any stellar fraction.
Isn't Fornax off in the middle of nowhere?
Fornax seems to have an orbit that is between 130 kiloparsecs and 150 kiloparsecs. That's the orbit that Hubble, you know, perform proper motion from Hubble. LEO-1, people have claimed, LEO-1 is moving now, it's a very interesting object. It's moving, it's one of the fastest dwarf galaxies. It's at 250 kiloparsecs, I believe. And it's moving like 200 kilometers per second from us. So it's escaping from us. Escaping is not the word, but it's moving away from us at very high velocity. And there have been some claims that LEO-1 might have a break radius here. If you fit the King profile, you see. It seems that this is an excess of material at outer regions. So people say, oh, maybe this is due to some tidal interaction. But LEO-1 is so far from us that actually our model would predict a break radius here, where not here. And this is a factor, I think, 10 larger than. In other words,
if it's so robust that has any sort of pericentric passage, it gives the same 0.5 factor.
Yeah, it's only actually you can calculate it. It's only a timing argument.
Well, there's a timing argument, but there's also the 0.5 pre-factor. LEO-1 has star formation that take pericentric passage.
Does it have some gas?
That's what Majewski found, right? So like a year ago.
But this would argue, this model cannot tell you whether this system has been disrupted, because what this model is telling you is that if this system has lost some fraction of the stars, the star would be now too far from LEO-1 to be detected.
You said only based on your 0.5 pre-factor.
The 0.5 prefactor actually depends on the potential. That's true. So if you change out the NFW, that prefactor is going to change.
I mean,
but the proportionality should be there, because it's just, it's telling you that, you know, some amount of components escaping, how long does it need to escape? And that should be proportional to the crossing time. How many crossing times are going to need?
Anyway, in your language, I would say it's an observational fact that VO1 had an encounter with Milky Way for what it was a few billion years ago. So then, is that inconsistent with your...
No, it's not inconsistent.
Well, you see the power law, right? That power law is produced by this, it's close to the power law, it's produced by this interaction, and then
it might be produced by the interaction.
Yeah.
This is what
there's just no tail.
Well, yeah, exactly. What the model is saying is that the claim that some observers have made that this actually corresponds to this unbound material is, it cannot be, because this unbound star should be far from VO1 by now.
Okay.
Sculptor also shows a very nice power law. Not clear whether it's disrupting. The problem with a power law that if you see something like that, doesn't necessarily mean that the system is disrupting. You could form a system with such a power law. So.
But the power law, I thought, wasn't part of disruption anyway. It was just part of being knocked about.
What the model show is that if you start with a truncated light profile, when you end up is with a power law.
But it's not from being disrupted. Because the potential is still very big and still contains all these stars.
No, it's not totally disrupted. It has lost a fraction of the stars. This is what I mean. When you lose some fraction of your stars, the remnants of the dwarf.
If the halo is big, maybe you can, you know, knock it about and not lose too much of your stars, and still wind up.
Yeah, exactly. This is exactly what happens. Some of the stars gain enough energy that can move from here to there and still be bound. There is actually a very old paper, I think it's Aguilar and White 68, that they did something like that analytically. And it, 86.
So it's R to the minus 4 is, I thought, was the stable point for if you have, I mean, this is if you have an isolated system generating its own potential, but that if you're truncated more shallowly than that, you'll lose mass into a tail that builds up to R to the minus 4.
Yeah.
Just with an isolated system, just from...
Yeah, the analytical, I've seen that. It's one page in a proceeding, I think.
So given this, how certain are we that these systems should have started with something that's truncated and not with something that's power lowish and with light scales? If the intrinsic profile was not truncated, then you can't make this argument anymore.
Exactly, yeah. I don't know, and so that's some question. The problem here that I haven't discussed is that some of these dwarf galaxies show two components, or it might be even more. And you can clearly distinguish these two stellar components in the kinematics, in the metallicities, and they have different spatial distributions. So I think, Nicola, you were telling me the other day that the Sculptor is one of the first systems with that people claim that they have to observe such bimodality in the stellar populations. So
I might amplify that particular point. I've actually done some of these calculations with a wide variety of different initial conditions. And if you make the tail extend beyond the instantaneous tidal radius when you start it, then the work done on the dwarf from removing the tail that originally exists is enough to cause significant expansion of the dwarf. That makes a new tail, which then gets removed, which then makes a new tail, and then gets removed, and pretty soon there's nothing left. So, and if you actually just decrease that by 20%, in other words, move that tail radius in 20%, then I get results very similar to yours. So exactly how you start these things turns out to be very sensitive.
We play with the concentration of the stellar component, and we find the same profile.
It's not so much the concentration as the extent of the original profile ab initio with respect to the tidal radius. I mean, obviously, yeah. I mean, make it very concentrated, and you'll have a remnant. But I'm just saying, you know, that this
Oh, yeah.
How you start this thing is pretty critical.
Right.
And
So I guess what these models are is, you know, they were created far away from the host. This is what you mean with the tidal radius. Are you talking about the real tidal radius or the king tidal radius?
No, the real tidal radius.
Yeah. So if dwarf galaxies form far from the host, they probably had the tidal radius farther out than the stellar component.
But I guess I'm just amplifying Andre's point. If you start with the power law of star, which continues, so you put, you know, a significant amount of mass outside the instantaneous tidal radius, you can actually get more, much more rapid evolution.
I'm surprised then that Leo wouldn't push you out of your chair based on this. He's just told us that you couldn't start with that because everything was concentrated in the center.
Yeah, but if there's a merger, then the stars can be dissipationlessly converted into a... All of these things have had mergers before they got into the Milky Way, right?
So these tiny little puffballs have major mergers?
Every dark matter halo in existence is
It's scale free at that level, right? So they've all done their merger tree thing.
But how much can these mergers change the stellar component? Because if there are puffy things that come and, you know...
If it's perfectly dissipationless and they're on parabolic orbits, then sigma doesn't change, but the scale radius doubles or something.
So you add the material in the outer regions, probably.
Anyway, you should organize these things by their orbits, and then because Fornax, you tell us, doesn't have a parasun, and Leo-1, we know have a parasun collision. So what's known about the rest of them?
Okay, so the pericenter interaction here, you can see what I've plotted is the tidal radius at the pericenter of the orbit. So this is what this dashed arrow is showing. So for example, for Sagittarius, if you calculate the instant pericenter at the tidal radius at the pericenter is well within the stellar component. For Fornax, this instantaneous tidal radius is out. It is beyond
the instantaneous tidal radius.
Well, the thing is that if you calculate the tidal radius, where you calculate it. In this case, it's calculated at pericenter.
Okay, but where's it calculated for an accident?
At pericenter. All of these are at pericenter of the my orbit estimate.
You told me that this pericenter was like 130 kiloparsecs.
Yeah, so that's the reason it's like, at 12 kiloparsecs.
So, anyway, so it doesn't have any effect?
No, not for Fornax. So, the thing is that for a Sculptor is also a similar thing. A Sculptor has a pericenter that is, I think, 75 kiloparsecs, if you believe the orbit estimate. And for Carina, the tidal radius is within the stellar component. So in that case, one would expect Carina to have lost some stellar fraction. And actually, for Carina, I can estimate where this unbound component should be. And it's a factor 2 larger than, where we see the break radius. So it's unclear whether it's the orbit uncertainty, what is. So all this, the problem is that proper motions are very hard things to measure.
So how well so is Sculptor?
Sculptor has two components, the stellar components.
No, no. How well is the orbit understood? How good are the proper motions?
All proper motions I have used here, except for Sagittarius, come from Hubble. So all of them, are the errors that you get are proportional to the distance of the system. So it's the same error, but the angular error is the same more or less. And then if the system is farther out, then the error will increase proportionally. The errors that I get here are not huge. I mean, like the percentage is 75 plus minus 10 or something like that. So it's not.
So to get back to what Juno was saying, can you use for Carina, for instance, if the fact that the green arrow doesn't fall where there's the break, what kind of change do you need to put in motion to put the green arrow at the position where you have the break? Is it within the uncertainty of the proper motion?
It's probably. So this the discrepancy is a factor 2, and I think the errors are like 30%, so it's probably 3 sigma.
The errors are 30% of what?
Of the position here. So this position, this green arrow has an error, an uncertainty, because the observational parameters have an uncertainty. For some minor, again, there is no deep enough data to know, which is surprising, to know how whether a profile can be truncated or not at larger radii, a large radii. But it seems that actually, if you believe the proper motion again, the tidal radius should locate beyond the light, the position of the light of the star. So we wouldn't expect any stellar mass loss here. And for Draco, there are no proper motions. Sextans, no proper motions. And Leo 2, no proper motions. Although here it seems that if we extrapolate, it could be like a truncated.
Leo 2 is far.
Leo 2 is far, yeah. So this is more or less what we can do. Again, it's not great. Like, this is astronomy. Like, it's difficult to say anything with certainty. We have tried even with little things that people have been discovering around. This is data that Nicola passed me. There are a couple of systems that seem to have, you know, power law distribution. Although, again, I don't know. I mean, how big the errors here? We don't know. We don't go very to the inner region, so the radii for which we have data is limited, as you can see. But it seems it's interesting, at least, that for the systems where we have deep enough data, there might be some power law profiles.
Which ones are the more elliptical ones?
Hercules, where it's not deep enough. C-Ven2 could be elliptical. Ursa Major 1, bottom left, is very elliptical, but the data is not.
It seems like they all have excess in the center. Right?
Yeah. So these are circular radii, and that makes the profile worse.
Like Andy said, to break the degeneracy, to say something with more certainty, if you knew the orbit, and you know, even if you don't know the outer profile, if you knew the orbit, and you knew that, for example, some of these galaxies were not too far from the precentric passage. You could compute, it seemed like from your movie, that right after the precentric passage, the star distribution becomes quite elliptical.
Yeah, that's right.
And then it sort of relaxes back, but right. For a certain amount of time, it is quite elliptical. And so, you know, if you plot evolution of ellipticity along with all the other structural parameters, it may be that some of these galaxies are caught right after the precentric passage.
But it doesn't work for Hercules, for instance, because Hercules is at 130 kiloparsecs. So it's way later than the simulations that he showed before. So you have to be very close to pericentra, basically, within a few hundred mega years.
But you don't know where its pericentra. Its pericentra could be 80 kiloparsecs, right?
Yeah, it's only going to get worse. It's a very radial orbit. It's quite far away and on a very radial orbit.
Okay. How fast does it move?
150 kilometers per second.
So I think right now we only have two constraints to know whether a system has been stripped or not of some fraction of the stars. And if the stellar distribution is truncated, I don't think you can have a system that has been perturbed by tidal stripping, or if you find some gas, because gaseous stripping is easier than stripping the stars from, since these systems are so deeply embedded. I think this is basically the main result of this investigation. I don't think we can go farther than that. And yeah, I think it's time to stop. I need a break.